Welcome to a special bonus episode of Hot Off the Wire. In this edition of our daily news program, we feature a selection of stories covering a variety of topics. I'm Terry Lipschitz, managing editor of the National Newsroom at Lee Enterprises and your curator of news. Be sure to subscribe to Hot Off the Wire through Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss daily news updates. And now, those stories from the Associated Press.
Talking all things Luigi Mangione and his criminal trials and the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, one in state court, the other in federal court, both in New York. I'm AP correspondent Julie Walker. With me are AP court reporter Larry Neumeister, who has a permanent desk in the federal courthouse, and AP's Mike Sisak, who has desks in both courts and one in Police Plaza. Mangione pled not guilty to all the charges. Mike, let's start with you. What is the latest?
A lot has happened since we last talked about Luigi Mangione. He's no longer facing the death penalty, and we now know when his trials will start. Plus, we heard from Mangione when he spoke out in court at a recent hearing. While there is a killing involved in both these cases, the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, the federal case was reshaped in January when the judge threw out the death penalty, threw out the federal murder charge in that case. Now, technically, it's only a stalking count, two stalking counts against Luigi Mangione, but they both derive from this killing. In the state case, it is a murder case. Both sets of charges could result in life in prison for Luigi Mangione. The state case beginning in June, the federal case beginning with jury selection in September, followed by arguments and testimony in October.
And Larry, let's talk about these juries. How do these juries differ, the state jury versus the federal jury? Where do we get these jury pools from?
Well, the federal jury comes from people from the suburbs, as well as people from Manhattan and the Bronx. So it's a very different makeup than a state jury, and it can reach a very different result in a lot of cases. However, I doubt it reaches a different result in this one. One thing that people need to understand, I think, is that most murder cases are tried in state courts. You know, they're not typically tried in a federal court. So when federal authorities try to charge a murder case, they couple charges with each other. And in this case, they coupled a stalking charge with a kind of a murder charge, and together they figured they could make it a murder case that could even result in the death penalty. But the judge threw out the murder count and just left the stalking charges because the way the charges were coupled weren't really compatible. And, you know, she felt the need to even explain herself, saying, "The analysis contained in the balance of this opinion may strike the average person, and indeed many lawyers and judges, as tortured and strange, and the result may seem contrary to our intuitions about the criminal law." I think what she was speaking to was the fact that people think, well, if you shoot somebody with a gun, that's a murder, and it's all pretty clear, so why can't you charge that in federal court? But it has more to do with the law itself and how it's generally applied. And as I said earlier, murder cases are generally brought in state court where charges are easily affixed and provided by, a long history of law.
Now, the Trump administration had wanted the death penalty. That's, the federal death penalty, and they're not getting it. Where does that leave us? And let's talk about that death penalty being taken off the table, Mike.
Right at the end of January, Judge Margaret Garnett made this critical decision to take the death penalty off the table. If you remember back in 2025, in April, the Trump administration, Attorney General Pam Bondi, announced that they would seek the death penalty against Luigi Mangione. Indeed, it was the first case in which the Justice Department under President Donald Trump's second administration was going to seek the death penalty. And at the time, the Attorney General Pam Bondi called the case a premeditated, cold-blooded assassination that shocked America. And this was really the launch of the Trump administration's renewed efforts to bring the death penalty in many, many more cases. There were no executions under President Joe Biden. With Trump, in his first term, there was an unprecedented run of 13 executions right before he left office in 2021. He had been an outspoken proponent of expanding capital punishment and indeed has spoken out about Luigi Bangione's case. So from there, fast forward to January, there are arguments in court, court papers filed. Ultimately, Judge Margaret Garnett, who was appointed by President Joe Biden, she had been a federal prosecutor in Manhattan, she rules that the murder charge in this case must be dismissed, and her reasoning, and that takes the death penalty off the table, her reasoning is twofold. One, under federal law, to bring that charge, prosecutors also must bring a charge alleging another crime of violence. The judge ruled that the stalking charges, while perilous, while important, were not crimes of violence, was not a crime of violence. One involves interstate travel, the other one involves use of electronics. So, in her reasoning, stalking alone is not a crime of violence. It may help perpetuate a crime of violence, a murder, but it is not itself a crime of violence. So that is one reason. The other reason, as she said in her ruling, was that she wanted to foreclose the death penalty as an available punishment to be considered by the jury. Essentially, what she wanted to do is take the death penalty out of the minds of jurors as they were weighing whether Mangione is guilty or not guilty of the charges left on the table.
Let's remind everyone of the crime. So it's the morning of December 4th. It's 2024. It's a midtown street. And Brian Thompson is on his way to a United Healthcare meeting. The prosecution says that Luigi Mangione, dressed in, you know, black with a hood, is, you know, standing on the street, you know, waiting, watching, looking. There's video of a man standing on the street with a jacket, a backpack, a hood. We don't see the face. The person's got a mask on. And they take out a gun, and there's video. There's actually also a witness you can see running by. The person takes out a gun, and they shoot Brian Thompson on a New York City street on the morning of December 4th, 2024. And then the manhunt goes on for 5 days, and we go to Altoona, Pennsylvania, where the McDonald's, or in the morning, the man is arrested. He's Luigi Mangione, and prosecutors say he's the man responsible. And actually, we have some of the 911 call from the McDonald's. Let's just take a quick listen, and then we'll pick it up after that.
Blair 911, what is the address of your emergency?
It's not really an emergency. I'm a manager at Plank Road McDonald's out here on the Boulevard.
Okay.
And I have a customer here that some other customers were suspicious of, that he looked like the CEO shooter from New York.
Okay.
So they're just really upset, and they're like coming to me, and I was like, well, I can't approach them, you know.
No,
so
of course
we
not.
Have gotten insight into the day of the shooting and the manhunt that led to this arrest in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Altoona is about 230 miles west of New York City. And there was a hearing in December, a three-week evidentiary hearing, where a judge heard testimony from some of the police officers involved, not only in the New York case, but also in the Altoona arrest. And he is weighing whether to allow certain evidence into the trial, whether to allow prosecutors to use as evidence a gun that was found, a notebook that was found, other items that were found in a backpack that police say Mangione had with him when he was arrested.
Let's take a listen to a tape of police going to that Pennsylvania McDonald's to arrest Luigi Mangione.
What's your name?
Mark.
What is it?
Mark.
Mark?
Yes, sir.
Mark what?
Rosario.
Sorry? Someone called. They thought you were suspicious.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is your ID on you?
Yes.
Now, prosecutors say that the gun matches the one that was used to kill Brian Thompson. They say that the writings in the notebook include entries about whacking a CEO. And so they are pointing to this as evidence linking Mangione to the killing. Because, as you said, the video, while shocking, while sharp, shows a man in a mask. There are no defining features. We don't have witnesses coming forward and saying, this is the person I saw do this act. So prosecutors really need to rely on what they found, what police found at that McDonald's with Mangione to tie him to this crime. Among other things, the name that he gave to police initially when they approached him at that McDonald's. He said that he was Mark Rosario. That same name, police say, was given to the clerk at a hostel in Manhattan where Luigi Mangione is alleged to have stayed some days before the killing. So we have gotten a lot more insight into where the manhunt went, where Mangione may have gone between the time of Thompson's death and the time he was arrested. Police found a bus ticket. They found notes where he even said a reminder to himself to pluck his eyebrows, his very distinct eyebrows, eyebrows that came up in that 911 call because some of the customers in McDonald's recognized the eyebrows.
The eyebrows may have given him away. Let's take a listen to that clip from the 911 call from the McDonald's manager.
He has his beanie pulled down, so the only thing you can see is his eyebrows, because I tried to Google it. I could try to calm them down a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, guys, it's kind of hard to tell with his eyes and his eyebrows.
We also know that when he went to stay at that hostel in Upper Manhattan, the clerk there, when he checked in, did want to see his face and did take a look at the eyebrows. And then when police released a sketch picture of him from the hostel, you could clearly see the eyebrows. And Larry, you've been in court with him. Mike, you have too. But Larry, what about those eyebrows? They are distinctive. I've been in court with them.
I'd say they're about the biggest eyebrows I've ever seen. I mean, they really take off. They take up a very large portion of his forehead, and when you see it, you're like, yeah, I could identify that again. I don't know if I could identify any other part of him, but those eyebrows, they're very distinct.
And is that something prosecutors are going to point out? I mean, in previous cases that you've covered in court, is a characteristic.
Something like that makes a big difference. I remember a terrorism case where the size of a defendant's nose made all the difference in the trial when a flight attendant was able to identify that he had sat on the plane she was on the leg before a man going to Japan was blown up in his seat. And she knew that he had sat in that seat, and the prosecutors were able to prove that he put a bomb underneath it. And she said, I would never forget his nose. And that was devastating testimony.
Now, let's go back to the courtroom and the appearances by Luigi Mangione. Every time he shows up in court, there is a large contingent of people there, spectators, coming to see him. Some are outside because they can't get in. Others are in the back rows. What do you make of this? You know, there's a lot of interest in this case.
He's a hero to some people who, for whatever reasons, hate the healthcare system in America and the insurance companies they have to deal with. And maybe they were rejected on some important drug they needed to help their health or save their life or some family member. And they have it. They're so angry about the healthcare system that when something like this happens, a man like Luigi Mangione becomes a hero to them. To other people, he's a monster. I mean, nobody wants to see people randomly assassinated on the streets of New York. So, you know, while there may be two dozen mostly women showing up in the court who are just huge fans of his, there's probably a silent, very large group that are very upset that a man came into Manhattan one day and allegedly assassinated the head of United Healthcare.
And Mike, you mentioned what we are learning from some of the court documents about Luigi Mangione, and also from some reporting, we're learning about this back issue that he had that you know, he seemingly had surgery for, and seemingly, you know, was one of the someone who, you know, got, I don't want to say cured because we don't know that, but he seems to have been able to overcome some really bad back issues with the help of surgery. And, you know, so, I mean, where does that leave us when it comes to his, you know, his writings, his reasoning, his ideas behind, you know, going what the prosecution says he did?
He documented his back surgery and his pain in posts online. He talked about the healthcare industry in posts and also in the notebook that was found. Police say was his notebook that was found in the backpack. United Healthcare says he was never a customer, never a client, never covered by United Healthcare, which is the largest health insurer in the country. He lived for a time in Hawaii. He was involved in the surf community there, although this back injury may have prevented him from doing that. He also, we know, took a pilgrimage to Asia some months before Brian Thompson's death. He was in Japan. He hiked up a sacred mountain. My friend Harubi Mecco from the New York Times wrote extensively about this journey that he took. He went to other parts of Asia. He was maybe in an altercation with some folks there, physical altercation. There was testimony at that hearing in December where he told a prison guard, the prison guard testified, that Mangione said he had been a witness to a fight involving some folks in Thailand. But the reporting that the New York Times had was that he indeed was involved in that altercation. Nonetheless, this is still a backstory that has many holes. There has been reporting that he latched on to the ideas and writings of Ted Kaczynski, the person known as the Unabomber. There are reports that he latched on to other writings and perhaps took on an anti-establishment feel in his life. But at the same time, we need to reiterate, Luigi Mangione has pleaded not guilty in the state case and in the federal case.
Luigi Mangione has also been very active in his defense. I mean, we see him in court conferring with his lawyer, his main lawyer. He has several, but his main lawyer, Karen Agnifilo. And we know that he's asked for a laptop. He's staying at the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is where Sean Diddy Combs was. It's where a number of high-profile defendants have been held. So we know that he's been he's someone who has been active in his own defense. But what do we know about the start of the trial? How long before we actually are in court with him on a daily basis and have a jury trial?
The state case is set to go to trial on June 8th. That is the beginning of jury selection. That could take some time. As Larry said, picking a jury is a complex process at times, and there's a lot of publicity for this case. In the state case, the jury is limited to people who live in Manhattan. And then there will be jury selection beginning September 8th in the federal case. So you have what, for now, is scheduled to be back-to-back trials involving the same basic set of facts or allegations. And Luigi Mangione, on February 6th, spoke out in court protesting this idea of back-to-back trials as he was leaving the courtroom, being escorted out by court officers. He said, "It's the same trial twice. 1 + 1 = 2. Double jeopardy by any common sense definition."
For members of the public, I want to say Mike and I will be writing a lot of stories about this because this is as high profile a case as you can cover. But this will play out like all murder trials do. Like in this phase of defense lawyers, his very competent and very talented defense lawyers are going to be challenging everything along the way. You know, in almost every murder case, defense lawyers ask that all the evidence be thrown out, saying it was gotten improperly. In 99% of those cases, the evidence remains in the case. And despite the headlines we might write that make it sound like, oh, this evidence could all get thrown out, it doesn't get thrown out. The trial proceeds like all murder trials, and eventually we reach either an acquittal, a conviction, or a hung jury that can't decide. So I wouldn't, as member of the public, get too caught up in the day-to-day switches on what's happening in the preceding the trials and the trials themselves. But ultimately, we'll reach a conclusion.
I want them to hang on your every word, Larry. So let them get caught up in the day-to-day so that they can read and listen to everything. No, but I understand what you're saying. However, it is fascinating, and popular culture and popular shows, you know, make people very savvy to all the court action.
Well,
so
there's actually a musical that's hit kind of off-Broadway regarding Mangione. I think it's coming up in April in New York.
It started in San Francisco last year, and it imagines what life is like for him behind bars at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where other famous detainees have included Sean Diddy Combs, Sam Bankman-Fried, Nicolas Maduro, the former president of Venezuela, and his wife are now locked up there.
That's right. I think we've covered a lot of ground. I think the only thing we didn't talk about is that Luigi Mangione has a cousin who's playing soccer in Brooklyn, not far from, not close, but not far from where he's being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center.
And that is something that's come up in all of the coverage. Mangione comes from a relatively wealthy family. He has a cousin who is a member of the state legislature in Maryland. His family has owned, if not one or two, country clubs in the region. And you said he has a cousin who's playing soccer in Brooklyn. He, for better or worse, is the most famous and perhaps infamous of the Mangionis.
For now, this is where we're going to leave it with Luigi Mangione and his state and federal trials in the killing of Brian Thompson, UnitedHealthcare CEO. I'm Julie Walker with Larry Neumeister and Mike Sisak. We're with the Associated Press. Thank you for listening. Warming winters are making ice thinner and less predictable, leading to more drownings as people fall through while fishing, hunting, skating, and just walking on frozen waters. A study found drowning rates surged fivefold when winter temperatures rose to just below freezing. In Alaska, indigenous communities face increased risks as they rely on ice for travel and food. The unpredictable ice season disrupts traditional hunting practices, pushing people to take dangerous risks. But communities are adapting with satellite imagery. However, the loss of reliable ice impacts both daily life and ecosystems. Robocalls, texts, and phishing emails from scammers are up this tax season, according to the FTC. Consumer advocates and government officials are urging the public to stay wary, stop and think before engaging with phone or text messages. Remember, the IRS will not contact you directly by text or phone. Officials say AI has likely contributed to an increase in fraud attempts. Scammers often use alarming language and QR codes to send people to fake websites where they ask you to verify accounts or enter personal information. Links may install malware or malicious software. I'm Julie Walker.
U.S. officials speaking anonymously say the military is deploying 3 more warships and roughly 2,500 more Marines to the Middle East. One official confirms the USS Boxer and 2 other amphibious assault ships, along with roughly 2,500 Marines of the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit, have deployed from their home port of San Diego and are bound for the Middle East. Iran is threatening to target recreational and tourist sites worldwide and insists it is still building missiles. The defiance comes nearly 3 weeks into the U.S.-Israeli strikes. I'm Mike Hempen.
The U.S. is ramping up its military presence in the Middle East as the Iran war continues. A U.S. official tells the AP the Trump administration is sending 3 more warships with roughly 2,500 Marines to the region. That comes a day after the administration said it'll ask Congress for another $200 billion for the war.
We're doing extremely well in Iran.
President Trump was hosting the Naval Academy's Commander-in-Chief Trophy-winning football team, with some two dozen seniors who will become uniformed officers in just weeks. He noted two officials who were not on hand, Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth and Joint Chiefs Chairman Dan Kane.
Stay in the Situation Room and you watch all those attacks that we're hitting those guys with.
Sagar Meghani at the White House.
Martial arts grandmaster and action star Chuck Norris has died. In a 1993 interview, Morris says he took up martial arts for a reason.
I was a very shy kid growing up, very, timid. By nature, I'm not assertive. So I had to develop that, and I couldn't do that without the confidence that I had gotten from my martial arts training.
In 2010, Norris was already a popular film and TV star, but he had a favorite.
8.5 years on doing the Walker series was probably the most rewarding 8 years of my film career.
While his tough man image became the stuff of legend, sparking Chuck Norris memes, in 1998, Norris said he knew his limits.
Well, that's way beyond my ability to dive out of a balloon and land on top of another one. And so, we bring professionals in for that.
Chuck Norris was 86. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
After nearly 100 years, CBS News says it's shutting down its radio news service as part of a round of layoffs, effective May 22nd. CBS News Radio went on the air September 1927, giving a young William S. Paley a start in the business. As part of the service, Edward R. Murrow broadcast reports from London during World War II. Currently, CBS News provides material to about 700 stations across the country. CBS News Editor-in-Chief Barry Weiss and President Tom Sabrowski say in a memo to staff that shutting down CBS Radio wasn't an easy decision, but a necessary one. I'm Donna Warder. After years of white Christians overwhelmingly supporting Republican Donald Trump, more clergy are now running for political office as Democrats.
This cup is the new covenant in my blood.
Reverend Sarah Trone Garriott, a Lutheran pastor and an Iowa State senator, is now running for U.S. Congress.
Well-intentioned people of faith have thought it was not appropriate to bring their faith into the public realm, and that left a vacuum that the religious right has filled.
James Tallarico, a Presbyterian church seminarian, recently won the Texas Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate. Democratic Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, a deacon for his Disciples of Christ Church, says his faith drives him to try to better this world. I'm Donna Warder.
NASA is moving its moon rocket back out to the launch pad following hangar repairs. The 322-foot rocket made the slow 4-mile trek at Florida's Kennedy Space Center. If all goes well, the Space Launch System rocket will blast off in early April with 4 astronauts. It'll be the first to fly to the moon in more than half a century. They'll zip around the moon in their capsule and then come straight home without stopping. Their Artemis II mission should have been completed by now, but hydrogen fuel leaks and clogged helium lines forced 2 months of delay. A Georgia woman has been charged with murder after police say she took pills to induce an abortion. 31-year-old Alexia Moore has been jailed in Camden County since March 4th. An arrest warrant obtained by a police investigator says Moore arrived at a hospital on December 30th complaining about abdominal pain and told medical staff she had taken a drug used in medical abortions. A 2019 Georgia law bans abortion after embryonic cardiac activity can be detected, which is typically about 6 weeks into a pregnancy. A 2024 study by the advocacy group Pregnancy Justice found that at least 210 women across the U.S. were charged with crimes related to their pregnancies in the 12 months after the ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade. I'm Haya Pinjwani.
The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 is much higher than official reports, with as many as 155,000 deaths outside of hospitals going unrecognized in 2020 and 2021. That's according to researchers who used machine learning for a study published in the journal Science Advances. The uncounted deaths cluster in the early months of the pandemic and were more likely among victims who were Hispanic or of color or living in the South or Southwest. Researchers point to a lack of available home testing early on, as well as uneven training for coroners. The results suggest about 16% of early COVID-19 deaths went uncounted. Politics may have played a role. Some coroners said families had pressed them not to list COVID-19 as a cause of death. I'm Jennifer King.
Descendants of John Ficklin, born a slave, have worked with 13 presidents for nearly 8 decades, from Franklin D. Roosevelt to Barack Obama. Ficklin's grandson, John Worry Ficklin, recounts that history in his new book.
We quietly served behind the scene to make progress in our country. And that's what my family did.
He spent 40 years on the National Security Council. His father, John Woodson Ficklin, worked 44 years as a White House butler and maitre d' and was an usher at JFK's funeral.
And I'm proud of my dad's service. I'm proud of my granddad. If you think about it, my dad and I both stand on my grandfather's shoulders.
Other Ficklin family members also worked at the White House over the years. His book, An Unusual Path, 3 generations from slavery to the White House, is out now. I'm Julie Walker.
Amazon says that it has started offering faster U.S. deliveries of select products for a fee. Customers in more than 2,000 areas can now get orders from among 90,000 items delivered in 3 hours. The charge is $4.99 for Amazon Prime members and $14.99 for non-members. 1 hour delivery slots are also available in some areas, with Amazon Prime members paying $9.99 for the 1 hour service. For non-members, it'll be $19.99 for that service. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Americans still dig French bulldogs, retrievers, and German shepherds, but dachshunds are increasingly hot dogs. For the first time in over 2 decades, the sausage-shaped hounds were among the 5 most prevalent dog breeds in the American Kennel Club rankings. Breeder Trudy Kawami.
Long nose, long ears, long body, long tail, short legs. So that they're amusing to look at.
The list covers 202 breeds, says the AKC's Brandy Hunter-Munden.
Our culture loves our labs and our goldens, and that is always going to be true. They're in the fabric of who we are. And the Frenchie holds tight. I think that it holds tight because of the way we live, more so than it just being a cute dog. It is compatible with apartment living, and many of us live in apartments.
The French Bulldog is number one, followed by retrievers, shepherds, dachshunds, and poodles. Julie Walker, New York.
Scientists have discovered what they believe is the oldest known recording of a whale song off the coast of Bermuda. A humpback whale singing in 1949, 20 years before the discovery of whale song. It was captured by scientists conducting acoustic experiments.
They had no idea what those recordings were of.
Peter Nyack at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution says they're important.
Not only allow us to follow the whale sounds, but they also tell us what the ocean soundscape was like in the late 1940s.
When the ocean was much quieter than today. Nyack says the recordings can help scientists better understand how new human-made sounds affect whale communication. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
A fleet of festive pubs on wheels brings a taste of Ireland to New England. The business began during the pandemic when brothers Craig and Matt Taylor started building an authentic-looking pub in a driveway. The Wee Irish Pub is a miniature Irish pub on wheels that's used for parties across New England. Craig Taylor says people enjoy it because of the atmosphere.
I think you're connecting to Ireland, so if you have some Irish heritage, you know, when the lights go down at night, it's definitely You could be anywhere and you feel like you're in Ireland.
Mark Cote recently hosted the pub in his Andover driveway.
Biggest surprise is how many people we can get in here. It actually helps with the atmosphere and we play music and the authentic feel of it.
The Wee Irish Pubs travel from March through December, serving as the centerpiece of St. Patrick's celebrations, bachelor parties, and family gatherings. I'm Mike Kemp.
Environmentalists want to permanently open a dam built for a canal that was supposed to cut through the middle of Florida from the Atlantic to the Gulf. The canal project was dropped more than a century ago because of environmental concerns, but the dam was built and now some people want it removed or opened. Nina Bhattacharya is executive director of Florida Defenders of the Environment.
By removing the dam, we would reunite the rivers.
we would reconnect Silver Springs, the Ocklawaha, and St. John's, and see natural flow of water. We would see the restoration of over 7,500 acres of forested floodplain. We would have springs reemerge. Wildlife would be able to move back and forth.
Supporters also warn the dam is aging and threatens nearby homes. Some anglers and local leaders oppose removal. They say the reservoir supports a strong bass fishery and a fragile rural economy. I'm Julie Walker.
The initiation process for young men and boys in South Africa is a secretive process that involves circumcision. Success for a participant means more status in the community, but sometimes the process becomes deadly. At least 48 participants died during the latest round of initiation ceremonies, including the grandson of this woman, who says her son told her he collapsed from a loss of energy. Traditional circumcisions can be fatal if cutting tools are not sanitary, practitioners are not trained properly, and wounds are not properly treated. Some initiation schools are not registered, and officials say it's difficult to monitor them. In just the first 2 months of this year, dozens of people linked to illegal schools have been arrested, including traditional surgeons and nurses. I'm Donna Water.
Greece launched an animal airlift to evacuate pets and their owners from the Middle East. There were emotional scenes at Athens Airport as small dogs leaped for joy after being let out of their special travel carry case. They were stuck because of the war. Nicholas Chrysakis, director of the Greek Secretariat for the Protection of Companion Animals, says our animals are not luggage.
To me, my pet, my cat is my family. There's no chance I'm gonna leave him behind.
Danny Kukolamati says her cat was pretty calm through it all.
They don't accept pets because of the situation. They don't accept pets in cabin, and they didn't accept pets in cargo.
Maria Thierchari says she wouldn't think about leaving Dubai without her dog, Matisse.
This is important for me. I didn't separate animal or my kids. It's the same.
The government-organized flights from Abu Dhabi to Athens carried 45 pets and 101 people. I'm Ed Donahue.
Two missing episodes of Doctor Who from the 1960s have been recovered in the UK. They were found by a Leicester-based charity called Film is Fabulous, which works to preserve old film collections. Justin Smith, a professor of cinema and chair of trustees at FIF, says the discovery is especially exciting for Doctor Who fans.
They're wonderful. I mean, what's interesting about this particular story arc, the Daleks' master plan, as I said, it was 12 episodes long, five episodes exist of those 12. What we have found is one and three. Two already exists. So it's nice that we've now got the run of the first three.
After the films were scanned and cleaned up, the charity organized a private screening for actor Peter Purvis, who played the Doctor's companion, Stephen Taylor, in the series. The restored episodes will be released on BBC iPlayer this year. Regan Garcia, London.
Kenya's capital is offering monthly leave to women for period pain. The new policy took effect in December 2025. It grants county government employees in the capital, Nairobi, 2 days off every month to deal with the pain and discomfort of menstruation. The aim is to improve productivity and well-being.
It starts with dignifying your own staff, for them to feel that they're respected and they're dignified.
Nairobi Governor Johnson Sakaja shepherded the new practice.
And that includes dealing with stigma.
There's been little public objection. Critics have said the policy could discourage employers from hiring more women. But advocates like Nairobi County Human Resource Manager Janet Opiata says such policies recognize menstruation as a legitimate workplace health issue.
And the feedback that I've gotten, especially from the staff that work in public service management, is that it's very refreshing. And when they come back, they're able to work even better.
Sakaja says that he believes that women perform better than men when they're supported. I'm Haya Pinjwani.
More and more vigilante groups are forming in Mexico. They carry military-grade weapons smuggled from the U.S. and patrol rural stretches, protecting communities from powerful drug cartels. Jesus Dominguez says citizens can't rely on the government to protect them. He says, that's why we are on watch and we take the security of our town in our hands. Dominguez's group formed in 2020 when a drug cartel tried to take control of several communities in the mountains along a strategic thruway that connects the cartels to Acapulco, where drugs and other illegal goods flow. Now the vigilantes are a 50-man force. Dominguez says, we are indigenous, we are parents who are farmers, and we defend what is ours. I'm Donna Water.
Activists prepare to send a flotilla of humanitarian aid to Cuba, assembling supplies and loading a vessel in Mexico as part of an international effort to ease shortages on the island. The aid flotillas, expected to include three ships carrying about 30 tons of food, medicine and solar panels, with some 40 people on board. In an AP interview, Tiago Avila, Global SUMAD fleet organizer, says the mission comes amid increased U.S. pressure on Cuba, including measures targeting oil shipments to the island. Saul Vega, a member of Mexico's Global Movement for Gaza, says fuel shortages have strained electricity production and disrupted daily life. She adds, the goal of bringing solar panels is to relieve the pressure on the Cuban electrical system, which is clearly necessary in the society we live in today. Three victims of bombings in England by the Irish Republican Army have brought an end to their damages claim against former Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams on what was to be the last day of the two-week civil trial in the UK's High Court in London. The three men's lawyer, Anne Studd, said the claim would be discontinued and that the development was related to an argument around abuse of process. Adams was being sued in the High Court for allegedly being directly responsible and complicit for decisions by the Provisional IRA to detonate bombs in England in 1973 and 1996. He was being sued for £1. That's $1.34 in damages by the three men. During stalled talks, Russian President Vladimir Putin's expected to try to expand his military gains via new offensives against his southern neighbour that will put even more pressure on Kyiv. Windfall revenues from surging global oil prices are filling Moscow's war coffers, and US air defence assets are being drained quickly by Iranian attacks across the Gulf, leaving little available for Ukraine in the fifth year of Russia's full-scale invasion. Ukraine's European allies have promised to maintain their steadfast support, but bickering over a major $106 billion EU loan to cover Kyiv's military and economic needs for 2 years has reflected the mounting challenges. As well as apparently intending to target recreational facilities, Iran's insisting it's still building missiles. Friday's show of defiance comes nearly 3 weeks into US-Israeli strikes that have killed a slew of Tehran's top leaders and hammered its weapons and energy industries. Iran's top military spokesman warned on Friday that parks, recreational areas and tourist destinations worldwide won't be safe for Tehran's enemies. General Abolfazi Shekarchi made the threat as Iran continues to be hit by airstrikes. It renewed fears that Iran may revert to using militant tactics beyond the Middle East as a pressure tactic in the war. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
On this week's AP Religion Roundup, Jehovah's Witnesses modify their stance on blood transfusions. Pope Leo reaffirms policies on divorced Catholics. And the war in Lebanon impacts the end of Ramadan celebration. Jehovah's Witness leaders are modifying their rules on blood transfusions by letting members choose whether to store and reuse their own blood for medical care. They still maintain bans on using others' blood in transfusions. The church's governing body announced the clarification on Friday, saying it came after prayer and deliberation. It says each Christian decides how one's own blood is used, including drawing it, storing it, and receiving it back for surgery. The group still bans transfusions of donated blood, which remains one of its most distinctive and controversial stances. Pope Leo is endorsing his predecessor's views on communion for remarried Catholics. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
Pope Leo XIV has summoned Catholic bishops to Rome in October for a special meeting on ministering to families. The Pope is strongly endorsing his predecessor Pope Francis's controversial policy that allows divorced Catholics who have not obtained an annulment to receive communion on a case-by-case basis after accompanying them on a spiritual journey of discernment. It's the 10th anniversary of Francis's document, The Joy of Love, which sparked controversy when it was released in 2016 because it opened the door to letting remarried Catholics receive communion. I'm Donna Water.
War in Lebanon is impacting celebrations marking the end of Ramadan. AP's Charles de Ledesma has the story.
In Lebanon, renewed hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah and displacement are draining the joy from Ramadan. Israel's strikes have displaced more than 1 million people in the country, according to the Lebanese government. The suffering has played out during Ramadan, with scenes of people reduced to sleeping in tents and on the streets or in cars. Displaced people describe numerous hardships away from their homes, and many say they cannot conjure up the spirit of what would have been normally a joyous time. Eid al-Fitr marks the end of Ramadan. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
I'm Walter Ratliff.
I'm Terry Lipschitz, thanking you for listening. Audio provided by the Associated Press. Be sure to subscribe to Hot Off the Wire on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode.